Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salier Report. This is John Titus, Catherine Austin Fitz. The big news of the week is that John Titus has made it all the way from the heartland to somewhere in the East Coast safely. Thank God.
Yeah.
And while you did it, you published a new great video and you look fine. You're back in the safe house.
Yeah, I'm a little worn out. I'm myself with a buddy of mine who looks like Neptune. Looks like I say he looks like Neptune. He looks like Santa.
Yeah.
So I'm worn out, but I did make it, and I did slip in one last video in Indiana.
Yeah.
Which we'll get to later.
Yeah, that's good. So we have quite a theme because there's a pattern. There's a new pattern developing. It's very powerful. Yeah. And what's our theme for the week?
It's the great resist is on. And that comes from, you know, we do this, you know, weekly podcast for a while, and for a long, long time, you know, we'd be waiting the whole show to get to our favorite part, which is pushback.
Right.
And more recently, you know, I'll put the show together, the spreadsheet, the sort of, you know, guide for the show, the menu. And I'll be looking at a story. I'm like, are we in pushback? And then I'll look and I'm like, no, this is part of Farmageddon or this is FedWatch. Pushback is becoming very normalized.
Everywhere. We've gone from people's saying, oh, it couldn't possibly be that big a conspiracy and that bad, to realizing, wait a minute, you know, what these guys are saying to do is wrong, to wait a minute, they're making money destroying our businesses and they're stealing. And wait a minute, you know, they're totally going to destroy everything. And you know something? No, I'm not putting up with this. And you're getting this, you know, it's like a momentum of people coming down and saying, I'm not doing this.
The two pressure points seem to be, number one, in chronological order, was the judges coming out and saying, wait, what are you doing?
Right.
You don't have any grounds for this. You need to have some reason basis on what you're doing. You don't have it. Okay, so that's going on. And then number two is with the energy, people are like, this green going green means I'm going to freeze to death or I'm going to, no. This isn't working.
You're sitting in West Virginia, they're putting your coal companies out of business and they're proceeding to do solar panels or windmills that destroy the environment because after 15 years, you just put them in the landfill and they're looking and saying, wait a minute, this is more expensive. It doesn't work as well. And it's hideous for the environment. What are you doing?
Yeah. And it costs us jobs. Well, you know, And that's a big, you know, we'll get to a story later.
Right.
You know, Manchin is becoming a real problem for the green energy fantasy. You know, he is.
Reality, you know, is becoming a real problem.
Yeah,
although
reality
it's
is becoming a real problem.
We saw tremendous headlines from the heat wave in the UK, including one from the military saying they were shutting down one of the air bases because the air... because the runway was melting.
Wow.
I mean, I didn't know that was possible. But anyway, but there's a rumor that Biden is about to issue an executive order for a climate change emergency. So we'll see what the judges have to say about that if that happens.
Yeah, the judges are hip checking the executive branch left, right, and center.
Right.
Good luck with that, Joe.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So the Supreme Court just said, no, the executive branch can't do this without Congress. So now Biden would come out with an executive order?
You're gonna try to end, at least before you had the pretext of legislation. Now you're just going to rule like King George III? rhetorical question. What's wrong with that guy?
Okay, let's dive in.
We'll start with war in the Ukraine. Gazprom declares force majeure, will halt gas flows to Germany indefinitely. I'm going to zoom in here. Let's keep it in the center. There we go. Gazprom recently said it can no longer guarantee its good functioning due to crucial turbines being previously held up in Canada related to sanctions. Canada just held on to them, wouldn't give them back. The Russian energy giant has declared force majeure to one major European customer. And then after a little mystery, the letter invoked extraordinary circumstances outside the company's control, Reuters said, citing a source saying the customer in question is Germany via the Nord Stream 1 pipeline. Go on down. Russian Gazprom has declared a force majeure on gas deliveries, meaning there won't be any. Now, since that story broke, it looks like, you know, Canada might magically find the turbine and Russia will relent. But Russia's, they mean business about this. You're not getting the gas for free. Quit playing games.
Right.
You know.
Right.
It's this Western mentality among rulers like Trudeau, who think, oh, we'll just throw a temper tantrum and, you know, they'll bend to us. And it's like,
well, but here's the thing. Printing fiat currency works for the ECB or the US as long as the commodities traders take it. You know, if the fiat energy game works as long as you have cheap energy. Once you don't have cheap energy, it can't work.
Right.
All it can do is produce inflation.
Right, right.
Which we seem to be getting a lot of. Yeah.
Indeed. We'll get to that. Okay, next, a war in Ukraine. No surprise here. Exclusive: Saudi Arabia doubles second quarter Russian fuel oil imports for power generation. This is a big, this is kind of a big story. Let me zoom in so we could see here. The increased sales of fuel oil used in power generations to Saudi Arabia from Russia show the challenge that U.S. President Joe Biden faces as his administration seeks to isolate Russia and cut its energy export revenues. While many countries have banned or discouraged purchases from Russia, China, India, and several African and Middle Eastern nations have increased imports. And that's really the story. In other words, if you're not going to let us, you're not going to take our gas, you're going to play games, we'll sell it to someone who can use it, including ally, Saudi Arabia.
It looks to me that this has been a concerted decision to rebalance the energy supplies east and to the G20. In other words, we've been rebalancing the gold supplies. Now we're rebalancing the oil and gas, the cheap energy supplies. And it's just moving the resources into the multipolar world and shorting the G7 nations. It's saying, you guys haven't enjoyed high consumer spending. Now we're going to move the energy, you know, to the essentially the emerging markets.
Yeah.
So, I tend to see these things from the top of the investment community as a plan. But that's what it looks like to me.
Right.
We're just rebalancing into a multipolar world. That's all that's happening.
Right. You're no longer the hegemon. That's not working anymore. The bus is leaving the station and it is heading east. And that's coming from the top. And this isn't the only story along those same
right.
lines.
But I think it's important to understand, and I have one wonderful ally is always pointing out, the dollar is very strong. But if you look at who controls the dollar, it's as much the city of London as New York, because we're talking about the euro dollar deposits, too.
Right.
So the dollar system is going strong, but the people who run the dollar system, it looks like to me, they want the energy moving, you know, rebalancing globally. That's what it looks like.
Yeah, there's a big power shift underway.
Yeah, and the Western consumer is having their legs cut out from under them.
Yep, sure are.
Yep. Right.
Well, okay. Along that those same lines, next story: Iran's central bank to swiftly. This is kind of, I guess it's kind of a pun here. Swiftly, we'll get to that.
I didn't notice that.
I didn't either until just now. Iran's central bank to swiftly implement banking agreements with Russia. Okay, so this is interesting. It's a two-tier story here. Let me try that one more time. Central Bank of Iran hopes to implement soon the memorandums on interbank cooperation signed with Russia, the agency's head said following meetings with Russian officials in Moscow in early July. Okay, so that's central bank. But then we get to the next paragraph, the retail level. Currently, there are still some unresolved issues in the banking sphere between two countries. For instance, the agency head from Iran pointed out that the issue of using bank cards issued by Iranian and Russian financial institutions on the territory of the two countries needs to be sorted out because they're different systems, right?
Right.
He noted that Tehran and Moscow in the future may link their banks using an interbank system similar to, and there's your
Swift.
Pun from,
yeah.
similar to SWIFT. So again, you know, you have this story here where the rest of the world's saying, you know, you're not going to let us play ball. We'll play without you. do our own thing.
Ever since the financial crisis, you're seeing literally hundreds of these agreements, central bank to central bank, throughout the sort of the G20 nations, trying to build resiliency outside of the World Bank, outside of the IMF, outside of the Fed, outside of the Bank of England. You know, they're trying to build much more resiliency country to country and be able to trade without having to go through the dollar.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
They're like, if you're going to cut us out of SWIFT, we'll do our own thing. SWIFT is, you know, it's kind of an overrated thing anyway. It's basically a system of post-it notes. I mean, I'm not kidding about that.
Well, I get back to it. They can do it as long as they have the energy.
Yeah.
Right?
That's true. Yep.
So if they have cheap energy, they can do this.
Yeah.
And that's what this, you know, that's the free riding the energy is over.
It sure looks that way.
Right.
You know, why didn't tell me this? Why didn't it end in 08? Because remember, what immediately preceded the 2008 financial crisis was $144 a barrel oil. Why didn't that stick?
First of all, it didn't stick. Russia was not ready to do what they're doing now. They didn't begin to have the internal resiliency. It was the sanctions coming out of the financial crisis that forced them to dramatically build up their agricultural and dramatically build up their own sort of stuff. And if you go back and look at the timeline and state of our currency, a lot of the different agreements and arrangements to go around the dollar central bank to central bank happened after the financial crisis. They built the infrastructure they needed. It was after the Asian financial crisis they started, but then after the financial crisis, they really sped up the building of that resiliency. And you have to remember, part of the challenge was nobody liked the U.S., but you had, in the Bretton Woods system, you had all these patterns and institutional relationships that were highly liquid and worked. So it was a huge pain to try and create trust outside of them. And you're talking about all these different groups who didn't trust each other. I mean, the Indians have real problems with the Chinese. The Chinese have real problems with the Russians. Do you know how much you have to hate the Bretton Woods and dollar system to get along with each other?
Right.
Do you know what I mean? So there were a lot of obstacles to get over to build trust, and it required a lot of practical, you know, like the Bank of the Moscow Central Bank putting an office in Beijing so they could swap gold. In other words, you got to get the engineers in the system to really build new train tracks and test them and try them and trust them. You know, you got to inch your way into building the trust you need to make something powerful outside.
Yeah.
And remember, you know, if you think they use deep state tactics on you and me, you ought to see what they do to those folks. Right.
I can only imagine. Yeah.
Right.
But I'll tell you what else has changed since 2008. 2017, Russia with hypersonic weapons.
Right.
Saying, now we got you.
Right. Now we can really do this. Although
now we got you.
The Cook incident, I don't know if you remember the Cook incident in 2014. When they did flybys against one of our, I think it's a battleship or a carrier. It's not an aircraft carrier. I think it was a battleship. But they were able to basically shut down their electronic systems, and do flybys without the ship being able to do anything. And it was sort of a way of saying, you know,
we got you. Yeah,
we got you. Well, it was another new, got you.
The new era.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, so and that's sort of the 800-pound elephant. No one's talking about Ukraine. Like, the reason you're not in Ukraine and you're throwing a temper tantrum is they'll wipe you out. They got hypersonic weapons. You can't catch them.
But I think, you know, I'm thinking of this very simplistically. What they're saying, what the energy producers are saying, is we're not willing to subsidize the G7 consumer anymore. So all that subsidy that allowed you politically to pay people off, we're pulling. Now, the reaction of the leadership is, okay, we need total control and a social credit system and, you know, CBDC, so we can totally control people, because once they lose their privileges, they're going to be impossible to manage and they're going to blame us.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the dynamic.
Right. But what I'm saying is, yeah, it's fine enough to say, we're no longer going to subsidize your energy and give you free stuff. But now with hypersonic weapons, you get the added phrase, what are you going to do about it?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Anyway. Let's cut to a chart of the ruble. Boy, oh, this is wrong. This is the wrong header. It's the wrong chart, actually.
Whoa, you want to do the euro?
Let me go to this chart. No, I don't. I want to go to. Okay. Let me go to the ruble. Sorry about that. I had the wrong chart up. There we go. Yeah. What has happened? Look at this. This is a monster drop. That spike doesn't look real to me. Right.
I see.
It is. Never mind. It is real.
It's definitely real.
The time frame of this is, I'm used to seeing it 2021 way back here.
Right.
And now we've got 2022 is basically here.
Right. You know?
So this is okay. We start and then boom, draw. That's a breathtaking chart.
Yes, it is.
Wow.
Yes, it is. So, you know, we've been rough on the Russians for quite some time, and now they're earning their way out of it. So,
yeah, man, that's an incredible chart.
Yeah. So these kinds of swings in the currency market are frightening to watch. That's a huge. Yeah.
Especially if you have contracts and debt. In one of those currencies.
Right. If you're not hedged, you could be up a lot or down a lot.
Yeah.
Especially when you're trading, it's nerve wracking.
I can only imagine.
Right.
You know, your job in investment advisor, that's way worse. In mine, you know, is litigation. The worst thing is being in a deposition and you don't know what the answer of the witness. You can destroy a case with a simple right. yes or no. Right. And that's tense. But once they give the right answer, you're okay. But what you're doing, you can get wiped out at any time.
Yeah.
That's gotta suck.
Yeah.
All right, let's keep it going. Back to Germany. This is space, military, and global turf wars sort of shifting gears. Germany's energy crisis is about to get even worse as Rhine water levels plummet. This is amazing.
It's interesting. I was driving past the Rhine 3 weeks ago. I didn't notice it that much lower. And I just talked last night. I was sharing this article with somebody in Lake Constance. If you go down on the map, you'll see from Basel, it flows across Switzerland into Lake Constance in Bavaria. She says the lake's not that much lower. So the Rhine comes in and out of Lake Constance.
Well, let's just take a look at this story. You can see in that map there, right there, the Rhine just cutting through the whole country. You know, that's incredible.
So the Rhineland, we're talking about the most economically productive territory in the world along the Rhine. It's just incredible.
I bet.
Yeah.
So here's the story. The declining water level of the Rhine, which has historically been a key infrastructure transit artery across Germany, continues to fall. And as it does, the flow of commodities to inland Europe is starting to buckle. That's not good. The 800-mile river runs from Switzerland all the way down to the North Sea and is used to transport tens of millions of tons of commodities to inland Europe. But with water levels at their lowest time, for the time of year in 15 years, there is a limit to how much fuel, coal, and other vital cargo that barges can carry up and down the river. Wow.
Right.
Not good.
Right. Similar problems in the Western U.S. with the drought.
Yeah.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Serious. You know, you find these like critical points, like you think everything's okay. You're like, oh, yeah, I forgot. If it doesn't rain. No, seriously. I mean,
I live in a farming community. It's all we think about.
Yeah. Right. That's how it was in Indiana.
Yeah.
Everybody, even people who aren't in farming, is hyper tuned to the weather.
Well, here's the other thing. And we were hyper tuned not only to the rain, but the water table. If you go through a bad drought and you see the water table drop to dangerous levels, it's really scary. And, you know, it may just be psychological, but you can feel it. You can feel, you know, the moisture going out of the world. It's scary to be in that kind of situation with very low water tables.
Yeah, not good.
Right.
A lot of trouble in Germany right now.
Yep.
You got a feeling there's a flashpoint is going to come over there, but because the Germans are they're rules followers. very obedient people up to a point.
Right. The
question is, what's that point? Okay.
I don't know.
Moving on to space military global turf wars. Next story from Financial Times. Mongolia says Russia-China gas pipeline will break ground in 2024. Let me scroll down to the sort of backgrounder here. Mongolia, which has a population of more than 3.3 million, not really that big, in a vast territory, is landlocked between China and Russia. Okay? So Mongolia expects Russia to begin construction of the Power of Siberia 2 gas pipeline through its territory to China within 2 years, as Moscow moves to connect its Europe supplying gas fields to Asia for the first time. The Power of Siberia 2 project has become critical to Russia as it faces the prospect of losing Europe as a market for its gas following its invasion of Ukraine and accusations it has weaponized supply to create a price crisis. The pipeline will connect Siberian fields that supply Europe, which has pledged to end its dependence on Russia's state-backed Gazprom, to China, where demand for gas is rising. So again, you know, Russia's going to find a source or a buyer for its
oil. I want to know where the equity investment is coming in to build Power of Siberia and how much of it is coming from the West.
Right.
So I would love to know where that equity investment is coming from.
Do you not think it could be coming from China?
Some of it, but I'll bet you some of it is coming. It's investment designated to move the energy east on the Silk Road, and some of it is coming from the West.
Yeah.
Now,
it may
first go to China, and then China puts it in.
But that would not be the first time the Western bankers play both sides of
They are playing both sides of this. If you look at the rebalancing of both the gold and the energy, they are playing both sides of this. I am sorry. This is not an East versus West.
Well, it is at some level, but not at the highest levels.
No, it's the bankers versus everybody.
Yeah, right. All right, last story in space military global turf wars. Iran to become SCO full member next year, according to reports. The SCO is a transcontinental political, economic, and security alliance. The report in the Chinese state-run Daily Global Times says Iran's accession to full membership of the Euro-Asia spanning organization will be finalized by April 2023. Okay. China... And then let's just go through the countries that I can pronounce. China, Pakistan, Russia, Tajikistan, India, and so forth are members. Iran, Afghanistan, Belarus, Mongolia are observer states. Look at this. This organization accounts for 40% of the world's population and 28% of GDP. So this is really sort of this is kind of the new world order there. That's where things are headed.
Right. So we're watching Iran as a result of the situation in Ukraine. Iran is finally moving on and getting integrated into more aspects of the multipolar world. So
yeah.
If you look strategically at where Iran is on the Silk Road, you know, their integration in is a very big development.
Right.
Right.
Right. It is. It's a big country.
Right.
You know, it's a major player. So again, it goes back to that article elsewhere says it was 15 years ago Iran applied for full membership. It's like, so you're going to give it to them now? So there was obviously some friction, pre-existing friction with Iran that has been overcome.
Oh, I don't think the friction was with Iran. I think the friction was with Israel, number one, and the U.S., number two.
So that was the hesitation to let Iran in, and now it's been overcome.
Right.
Yeah, things have changed.
Or simply, Israel and the U.S. ability to object is diminished in effectiveness.
Boy, you know, again, the bus is leaving the station.
Right.
You know? The hegemon, that card's spent.
Right.
What you got another move?
It's not over, but it's
right.
Here's the thing. You can't, if you look at the fundamental economics. It makes fundamental economic sense to rebalance and pull away from the G7 consumer and rebalance globally. It's the argument for fundamental productivity. You can't stop it. It's, you know, it's like gravity. So it's going to happen.
Right. Yeah, there's only so long you can prop the world up on financial
engineering. But I happen to believe the big financial investments that made a fortune on the rise of the Western consumer are going to make a fortune on this one, too. They can make more money, you know, rebalancing than they can continuing the existing system in the West. So
yeah.
I think they're on both sides of this trade. I really do.
They always are.
Right.
You know, they're on the both sides of every crash.
Right.
So yeah.
It's funny. Right. I was just showing somebody a copy of Anthony Sutton's West Wall Street trilogy, you know, his three books. And he goes through all these different, you know, events like the Bolshevik Revolution. It's just one explanation of how they, you know, these guys engineered every one of them. It's unbelievable.
That's funny. I just started reading that.
Yeah.
The trilogy. It's great. And now I can't find it. It's in a box somewhere.
You'll find it. It's great.
I'll find it. Yeah.
It'll be back.
It's really heavily, really well researched.
Yeah, Sutton was good.
Yeah, I don't read fast. It's a slog for a guy like me. But anyway, let's go to FedWatch. Okay. No surprises in FedWatch. This is a good story. Wall Street Journal, Fed officials preparing to lift interest rates by another 0.75 percentage points. There's really, the story kind of hones in on the rub here. Federal Reserve officials have signaled that they are likely to raise interest rates 0.75 percentage point later this month for the second straight meeting as part of an aggressive effort to combat high inflation. Policymakers left the door open to a larger full percentage point increase at the July 26-27 gathering, but some of them simultaneously poured cold water on the idea in recent interviews and public comments ahead of their pre-meeting quiet period, which began Saturday. And what they're worried about is if you hike it too much, you're going to get a recession. And they say way down here, I found this kind of interesting. Economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal this month put the chance of a recession sometime in the next 12 months at 49%. How's that for waffling? So it's 50-50 chance of a recession in the next 4 months, the next 12 months, the Fed is saying. So they're walking a tightrope with the interest rate.
It doesn't make sense to me because I think we're going to cover it today, but if you look at this survey that says 35% of small businesses in America couldn't pay their June rent, that's not a recession. That's a depression.
Yep.
You know, I think the survey indicated, and surveys are imperfect, so I don't want to say this is perfect, but what was it? 51% thought they might not be in business in 6 months.
Well, we'll get to the story.
That's a depression. That's not, maybe there will be a recession.
Right.
Because I go back to insiders and outsiders. You know, you're slaughtering the outsiders and you're using government regulation, you know, fiscal and monetary policy to destroy them. I mean, you order them legally to close for months, right?
Right.
So I engineer the destruction of millions of businesses. And then I say, oh, well, there might be a recession. I think what they mean is our publicly traded companies might slow down.
I think that's exactly right. Because the Fed is using QE to prop up, to keep the money supply basically flat, right?
Right.
By duking money to the insiders. But if that part is maintaining, it means, that, like you say, the insiders are going up and the outsiders, you know, flyover America is going down. That's a depression.
Right. So depression here, boomtown here. And the average in the Cuisinart is a recession.
Yep.
What?
Yep. So you put one arm in the furnace and you put another arm in an ice pack and you balance out. You're like, your average temperature is okay. I guess that's a theory.
Did I read? I got to tell you another FHA story. So I get to FHA and they introduce me to the actuary. We have one actuary for $300 billion. And so he gives me this huge presentation about, you know, the actuarial dynamics and characteristics of the portfolio. And I'm listening to it, and it makes absolutely no sense to me. It's like a giant Cuisinart. It's the average of everything. Well, to make a long story short, I had raised money for George H.W. Bush. And as a result, what I got was I got a pair of cufflinks, and the accountants moved over to report to me. And once I got control of the accountants, I took all the numbers and I broke it down into, we had 10 regions and 80 field offices, and I broke it down to 80 field offices because all real estate is local, right?
Yeah.
And what I discovered in those 80 portfolios, there was not one portfolio that matched his profile. Not one. Right. Every profile was remarkably different than the average, and every portfolio required a much different strategy on how you're going to deal with it than the average. And if you base your policies on the average, you would get insanity.
Right. It's a bimodal distribution, and he's presenting it as a bell curve. Like, it's not working right.
Well, but, you know, huge damage is done with averages. Anyway, so they're killing this one, and they're pumping this one, and the average is a recession. So
the average is a recession. You know, let's look at some prices. The prices are another thing that is, you know, not all inflation is created equally. Let's go to this story from Statista. U.S. inflation hits food staples hardest. Oh, great. The price of eggs rose by a third between June of 2021 and June 2022, and butter, flour, chicken, and milk also showed some of the next biggest price increases. That's for sure. That's true about eggs. I think it's way more than a third, frankly. Dairy was one of the food classes most affected by inflation, becoming on the whole more than 13.5% more expensive over the course of a year. Fresh vegetables increased in price more moderately at an additional 6.5%. You're dreaming if you think that's true. That's ridiculous. U.S. inflation hits food staples hardest. And then here you got the graph. Eggs. But this eggs, you know, I see eggs. I've seen eggs $5.99 a carton in stores. They're for 18. But look at those price increases. There you go.
I honestly don't understand how some people are making it. The, you know, I sent another check to my local food bank for years. I used to be on the board of the New York City Food Bank. I love food banks. I think food banks do a huge amount of great work and make a huge difference. And the food banks have gotten just unbelievable demand since COVID started. But the reports are they're getting more and more demand. So if you have an extra nickel and you want a great charity support, find your local food bank and help them, because they, you know, they transfer food directly into people's, you know.
Right. Cars.
Below.
Yeah.
Not everybody who uses a food bank can afford to buy a car. So
that's true. But
there's
walk-ins. There's also, you know, soup kitchens, similar thing, but people aren't driving up to soup kitchens. They're walking, you know, different story.
Right.
Slightly different market.
Yeah, so find your local food bank and support them, because they're doing, the pressure on them is huge.
They're doing God's work, not Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs.
Okay.
Okay, here's your story. Survey, a third of U.S. small businesses can't pay rent because of inflation. Let's see if I can get that. Yep. Small Business Network Alignable released new survey results that found that 35% of U.S. small businesses owners could not pay their rent in full or on time in June. Most small business owners attribute this worsening situation to record-breaking inflation, which includes escalating gas, labor, and supply costs. Simply put, there's less money available to pay the rent. And then down here, you can see Illinois and Texas lead the nation in rent delinquencies. So you got Illinois, Texas, New Jersey. While they're still high, rates dropped in Massachusetts, New York, Florida, and California.
Part of it is that they're, you know, replacing their inventory as they make sales is going up faster than they can afford. You know, so their demand for working capital is going up. But I also think, John, you know, part of it is people have less money to spend. Clearly, consumer credit is going up a lot because people are using debt to pay their bills. But, you know, don't tell me that shutting those businesses down for weeks and months at a time didn't have something to do with them not having the resources they need to finance the inflation.
Right.
Right. So, so I think, you know, I don't know how much capital you wiped out by the COVID restrictions on all those businesses, but that's a huge amount of capital, and that capital would have been available to help them through a bad patch.
Right.
You know, not to mention that at the same time you shut down their businesses, you printed a lot of money that caused the inflation, gave it to your pals. So
yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
But don't worry. Now we're going to raise your interest rates.
Unbelievable. Okay, let's keep it going. In FedWatch, this is great. Bernie Sanders is back. There's a story from Common Dreams. I love this picture. I love this picture, this photograph here. I'm not really sure. Look at Bernie's face. Anyway, Sanders warns Congress is working behind closed doors on $50 billion in corporate welfare. This is interesting where this money is going. What is Congress doing right now at a time when we face so many massive problems, asked Sanders. The answer is that for 2 months, a 107-member conference committee has been meeting behind closed doors to provide over $50 billion in corporate welfare with no strings attached. Here's the interesting part. To the highly profitable microchip industry. Uh-oh, that doesn't sound good. As Politico describes it, this would shower the semiconductor industry with $52 billion of incentives to ramp up chip making in America. And then they get into the sort of the political divide here. China hawks like the bill because it makes the U.S. less reliant on Chinese import. Sanders, who voted against the Senate's bill passage in March, has argued that it should contain safeguards to ensure that taxpayer funding doesn't go to companies that engage in union busting, offshore U.S. jobs, or buy back their own stock. In May, Republican and Democratic senators voted down motions from Sanders that encouraged such conditions. I bring up that kind of left-right divide because it's like nowhere in that story is anybody asking, hey, what are you doing with all, why do you need all the new microchips, guys?
Right, because it's control, it's CBDCs.
Yeah.
Right, they need it for the financial control grid.
Yeah. We're pouring $50 billion into microchips, right? And you're making a left-right issue. It's like, well, what's the rush with the microchips?
Well, here's the other thing. You also have the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization, going through. And if you look at the pork in that, right, the pork in that is, Sanders didn't happen to mention that, but it's kind of like looking at the small pork pot instead of the big pork pot.
Yeah, exactly. At least he's saying something, but. Right. Okay, but let's cut to that story because it's next. Inside defense, Senate lawmakers bring defense authorization bill to floor. I'm sure you could talk about this. While the bill authorizes a total of $847 billion for national defense, it is aligned with an overall national defense top line of $858 billion. Biden requested $813 billion. So he requests $813 and end up with $858. Okay, and then they quote Jack Reed, a Democrat from Rhode Island, from China's emergence as our most consequential strategic competitor to Russia's assault on Ukraine, the challenge before us are momentous. To ensure our technological superiority, it strengthens our cyber, hypersonic, relate to the party there, guy, artificial intelligence capabilities, giving our forces advantages. This is a tell. On the battlefields of the future, because we're not doing so good on the battlefield of the present. But that's a lot of scratch.
So it's a lot of scratch. It's important to understand that they could never do this unless the central bank was willing to monetize it all.
Yeah.
Right. So I see this as central bank injection, largesse.
The giveaway that that's the case is Biden. They're given $50 billion more than Biden. Joe Biden asked for. Okay. This guy's sitting on the world's biggest deficits ever, and you beat him?
Right.
Wow. That's a lot of money.
That's a huge amount of money. That's, you know, when people say there's no money, I said, you know, there's more money than you can possibly imagine. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I told you I printed it out. It's more than 2,000 pages. I don't usually do this. I did the last time I did this is when they took over Fannie and Freddie. Because it's all in the details, and there's been lots of rumors that there's some untoward little delicious treats. Skidmore found some, in fact, because I sent it to him. And so I've been skim reading this one. It's over 2,000 pages. It's like this high, and I'm gonna see what I can find.
Four reams of paper.
Yep.
How do you? I have to have staples. How do you attach those pages? Attach them. Do you put them in notebooks or binders?
Oh, I don't attach them. I just put them in a pile. So you know, I'll grab a handful, read that, put it down, grab another handful, read that. No, I don't even try and attach it.
I'd have to have binders. That's
It's gonna be converted into pulp that we use as firewood in the wood heater, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. The next story is one of the first ones in The Great Resist is on. You know, here we go. So let's get in the main. You know, the mainland is pushing back. This is from Mishtok. Hooray,
good,
Senator.
Good
Senator
work,
Mish.
Senator.
This is great. And good work, Mish, here. Senator Manchin finally kills Biden's Build Back Better initiative. Thank God. Okay. Manchin told Majority Leader Chuck Schumer he's only willing to support legislation to lower prescription drug prices and extend enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies. His decision is a de facto veto of Biden's hope to revive the economic plan that fizzled last year, angering Democratic progressives who had been counting on sweeping policy wins. Manchin's vote is pivotal in the evenly divided Senate, where Democrats need a united caucus to pass the economic passage by simple majority under special budget reconciliation rules. Go on down, and we get to Senate Finance Chair Ron Wyden. Gives away the mentality of the progressives here. This is our last chance to prevent the most catastrophic and costly effects of climate change. Nut. We can't come back in another decade and forestall hundreds of billions, if not trillions, in economic damage and undo the inevitable human toll. That just shows you the mentality there. Like, we don't really care what's going on. We don't care how much your food costs. We're worried about this Chicken Little story we've been hearing for 50 years.
So here's the problem. The problem is that the more renewable energy gets rolled out, the more people who know about energy can cost out the real economics of it, and they realize it's madness.
Yeah.
You know, so reality is interfering with the plan.
It is. It is. And more people are waking up to it.
Right.
You know, Manchin's like, they're not going to crush my state like that.
Right.
You know, and let's go to the next story. So even the Wall Street Journal editorials.
Well, it's one thing to crush my state because I'm out of date and too expensive. It's another thing to crush my state because I'm highly productive and highly relevant and everybody needs what I have. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. So Manchin's standing on solid ground here. That's the people who are being put out of business are beginning to realize they're on solid ground and they need to punch back.
Yeah. Right. Right. Speaking of punchback from the Wall Street Journal of all places. Good Lord.
I know. It's that bad.
and this isn't even the worst, the most incredible one of the week. This is number two.
Yeah.
Well, let's cut to this one. The Wall Street Journal opinion pages. West climate change policy debacle. Pretty strong word. Soaring oil and natural gas prices. Electricity grids on the brink of failure. Energy shortages in Europe and with worse to come. The free world's growing strategic vulnerability to Vladimir Putin and other dictators. These are some of the unfolding results in last year caused by the West's utopian dream to punish fossil fuels and sprint to a world driven solely by renewable energy. Man alive. And then they go on. Here are some of the consequences. I'll just cover one bullet point. I think there's three. People, even in affluent countries, are learning that they can no longer take reliable electric power for granted. Texas's grid operator this month told residents not to use major appliances to avoid rolling blackouts. So the journal stand, you know, enough's enough.
Right.
Enough.
Right.
You know. But the most incredible pushback is the next one.
Okay.
It's like, you have to be kidding me. Like, this is unbelievable. This is from The Last American Vagabond. New York University School of Law warns digital ID paving a digital road to hell. NYU Center for Human Rights and Global Justice has issued a chilling warning. It's a 100-page report on this that issues, and they quote it here, Last American Vagabond quotes the NYU report. Today, our digital welfare state and human rights project launches a new report entitled Paving a Digital Road to Hell, a primer on the role of the World Bank and global networks in promoting digital ID. Governments around the world have been investing heavily in digital identification systems, often with biometric components. The rapid proliferation of such systems is driven by a new development consensus packaged and promoted by key global actors like the World Bank, but also by government foundations, vendors, and consulting firms. What is going on that NYU would push back against digital ID?
I would say the major donors are unhappy.
I mean, NYU is one of the sources of propaganda.
Well, but here's, and especially if you look at who's their board of directors. I had to, when we interviewed Mark Crispin Miller, and he was telling me all about all the things he was dealing with at NYU, I went to the board and I said, do you realize, so I went through the whole board. But, you know, I it's what I said before, John, when we got Corey Lynn to write that series on vaccine passports and published vaccine passports and CBDC together, you know, my experience giving that and asking lots of people to read it was, they just didn't believe how bad it was. They just couldn't believe that it was really this bad. And then, then they're like, oh my God, this really is slavery. This is, you know, you're not exaggerating. This is horrible. And right. I remember your face the first time I talked to you about it. And you're like, do you remember? You were just, this is really bad.
Well, the eye opener for me was the Carsons. You know, right. I was like, this guy, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
I mean, the gloves were off.
Right.
I guess, like, this guy, and it was right out of his own mouth. It was like, gives us total control.
Yeah. We make the rules and like, we can enforce them centrally.
Yeah. I mean, right. And if an abuser tells you I'm an abuser, you know, believe him. Right.
Well, but I just think you got millions of law school students and professors and, you know, all kinds of people around the world, and they don't want to live under total control by Carsons.
Yeah, right.
So it's you know, the pushback is happening.
Yeah, it is. It's becoming normalized. You know, the great resist is on, like we said in the theme.
The great resist is on. My favorite one is still coming up. That may be your favorite one, but my favorite one's coming up.
Just I'm gobsmacked that NYU, of all places, is pushing back against Augustin Carsons.
Like, good.
You know, anyway, okay, let's go to the next one. The Nitrogen Wars, a lesson from Netherlands. Carrots for farmers, not sticks. The ruling coalition wants to cut emissions of pollutants, predominantly nitrogen oxide, and ammonia by 50% nationwide by 2030. Ministers call the proposal an unavoidable transition that aims to improve air, land, and water quality. And again, you know, this unavoidable transition. Who are you kidding? But that's how, you know, people like them, they like Ron Wyden think. Between 1990 and 2015, the consumption of nitrogen fertilizer was reduced by 50% and animal excretion decreased by 40%. Evidently, this reduction was not sufficient. The Netherlands is doing it wrong. A far better way to meet these goals is to use a plan to increase farmers' wealth with tax breaks. I'm not going to get into the details of that, but
let me tell you something.
Yeah.
I live right on the IJsselmeer, right next to the North Sea. And every day back and forth, and I don't know whether they're NATO or Netherlands, you know, the F-35 type fighters go flying back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And apparently their emissions are not a problem. And I have to tell you, if you compare their emissions to the cows, you know, it's a no-brainer. The F-35s win.
Yeah, right.
Right. So you know, and they've accepted the corporate, you know, jets from aviation tax in the EU, and you know, corporate or yachts have been accepted. And, you know, the whole thing is just a taking. It's an excuse to take land from the farmers.
Right. It's a two-tier system, and you try to put the scientific gloss on it, and it's just nonsense.
Right. And it's somebody said to me the other day, well, it's the farmers. It doesn't affect me. I said, really? You like food?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And what was the other? There were a couple of different spins, but you know, they said there are two sides to every argument. I said, no, you know, the government is taking the land from the farmer by rule, by fiat.
Yeah.
And if they can take their land, you're next. So if you let them take their land, they're going to come and they're going to take your house and your land. And what is it about it's 2030 and you have no assets that you don't understand?
Right.
So don't let them pick you off one by one. It's all, right. You know, it's all or nothing. All of us.
Yeah. And that's how the powers that be do it. They pick you off one by one, you know, and they start with the weakest. And everybody goes,
here's the funny thing is the Dutch farmers are not the weakest. They're one of the strongest. That's the odd thing.
In the U.S., my experience in the U.S. is they start with the weakest.
Right.
You know.
Right. Well, the Netherlands has a big partnership with the WEF on food.
And, yeah, right.
And so, you know, we just had a big place that distributes synthetic food burned to the ground 2 weeks ago.
Yeah,
Have a bad fire.
Yeah, right. I saw that. It was one of the stories that didn't quite make the cut we were going to cover, but yeah, that's right.
Right. So a lot of tension over farmers all throughout Europe.
Boy, big time. Okay. Last story in FedWatch. Here we go. This is great. I love this. Women now make up the largest group of new gun owners. The last couple of years has pushed many on the fence people from owning zero guns to at least one gun. Of those new gun owners, women now make up the largest group, accounting for nearly half of new gun owners over the last 5 years. A study conducted by Harvard, one quarter of the women surveyed said self-defense was the main reason they wanted to purchase a firearm for the first time, with many citing the uptick in civil unrest and reduction of law enforcement assets during the summer of 2020. Another reason cited by many women as to why they've armed themselves is that many of them are now living alone and feel more comfortable having a firearm in the home for self-defense. Wow, sign of the times, right. No?
If you study the statistics on gun ownership, there is no doubt about it. The group that benefits the most from gun ownership is women.
Yep.
You know, it shifts the balance of power.
It really does. Right. A man versus a woman, a man's going to tear a woman limb from limb. Right. But a gun equalizes that fight.
Right.
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 Yeah.
Do you ever remember that scene in Tomb Raider where he's in the street and a guy has this huge bullwhip and he's cracking it around and you know, he's about to kill him shortly. And the guy just pulls out the gun and goes bang. It's a perfect example of shifting that balance of power.
I never saw Tomb Raider.
Oh, it's great. It's great. I loved it. Yeah.
I haven't seen a lot of classics. Shameful. Okay. Let's shift gears. This next story, the CBDC and crypto. Are you ready for this? We knew this was coming. We talked about this for a long time. We knew this was coming, and here we go. ECV says Bitcoin ban probable due to climate concern. The climate gods giveth, and the climate gods taketh away.
Taketh away.
Here we go. A new ECV research article assessing the climate risks associated with crypto assets has come down hard on blockchains that use proof-of-work consensus algos, primarily Bitcoin. The report compares energy-intensive proof-of-work algorithms to fossil fuel cars by likening proof-of-stake, which uses an estimated 99% less energy than proof-of-work, to electric vehicles. So proof-of-work, gas, causing Cadillac, proof-of-stake, that's the electric car. I mean, it doesn't get any more stark than that between good and evil, right?
If you look at the smart grid and the financial control grid, they're energy hogs. They're huge energy hogs.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so you keep trying to do more central control in a way that's destroying productivity and is more and more energy expensive and more human expensive. And, you know, the question is, that's why I'm so glad to see this resistance, because you're talking about unbelievable environmental and human destruction if you keep implementing this.
Yeah. Let's cover. I want to touch one last thing in this article. It's interesting. Ethereum, the second largest cryptocurrency by market capitalization, plans to switch from proof of work to the more energy efficient proof of stake consensus algorithm by the end of 2020. So in other words, Ethereum got the memo here. They see the writing on the wall.
Right.
And they're changing. So I don't know what Bitcoin is going to do.
I don't know, but if you look at how many transactions they process, I don't see it.
Yeah.
I don't see it, but we're still coming up to my next favorite, my favorite story of the week.
Yeah, okay. I'd forgotten what it was. Now I know. I'm looking at it right now.
When I saw this, I couldn't believe it. It was like, where have you been?
So, well, you know, better late than
better,
never.
Better late than never.
Here we go. Wall Street on Parade. Over 1,600 of the brightest scientific minds in technology have signed a letter calling both crypto and blockchain a sham. The letter was sent to key members of Congress and to the chair of the Banking and House Financial Services Committees. It is signed by more than 1,600 computer scientists, software engineers, and technologists from around the world. The quote from the letter here, blockchain technology cannot and will not have transaction reversal or data privacy mechanisms because they are antithetical to its base design. Financial technologies that serve the public must always have mechanism for fraud mitigation and allow a human in the loop to reverse transactions. Blockchain permits neither. What blockchain does is shift some of the trust in people, institutions, to trust in technology. You need to trust the cryptography, the protocols, the software, the computers, and the network, and you need to trust them absolutely because they're often single points of failure. When that trust turns out to be misplaced, there is no recourse. In other words, you can't reverse any transactions.
Right, right.
Wow. One last point. Let me get one last thing in this story. This is it. This is great. Let me look at this. Brainerd, Lael Brainerd of the Boston Fed's idea. She wants to regulate crypto. And in the Martin's ad, China had a better idea. It outlawed crypto, as have 8 other countries, with a dozen more countries severely restricting its use. So, you know, Martin's taking a poke at Lael Brainerd there.
So they don't, the technologists don't get into it. But the other thing is, if you have a technology which is related to a series of people who are operating and managing it or the infrastructure it runs on, and you can manipulate and control them, the harm you can do with a technology like this is unbelievable and off the charts. And a lot of the people who say you trust the technology say that because not only do they not understand the technology, but they don't understand the human operations that can manipulate and control the technology.
Right.
And they just have no sense of how the control system works.
Right.
You know, but they feel we can trust the technology. And I think that personally is insanity.
I trust the law.
Just
tell me who's behind it.
Right. They don't know.
And you can't tell me.
Right.
Right.
But they also don't understand how it can be manipulated.
Right.
So anyway, so it's wonderful to see technologists beginning to pile in and start here because, you know, the technology is not trustworthy. And we need to have a conversation about that before anybody goes any further.
Well, the people aren't trustworthy. So why would you trust the tool of the people who aren't trustworthy?
Exactly. There you go.
I don't understand that anyway.
Well, here's the thing. You have grappled at a very, very detailed and deep issue with the issue of sovereignty.
Yeah.
So the PDF is on our sovereignty. We're at the printer. The hard copies will come out. The PDF is available on the website. If you haven't read John's piece on sovereignty, you have to do it because this is the core issue. We don't have a financial problem. We don't have an economic problem. We have a sovereignty problem. That's the problem. And technology can't solve that problem.
Right. We have a legal problem. In turn, it's a sovereignty problem. Ultimately, it's a sovereignty problem.
Well, it's a legal, it's a cultural, and it's a governance problem.
Right.
So.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Shifting gears again to Farmageddon. And this is, again, the great resist is on. Here we go. This is from My Droll. I don't know this publication, but the story is great. Court blocks Biden administration from punishing unvaccinated Air Force members. Okay. Federal district judge in Ohio has temporarily blocked the administration from enforcing COVID-19 vaccine mandate on thousands of U.S. Air Force service members who remain unvaccinated after having opposed the shot on religious grounds, but have had their religious exemption applications denied. The judge's ruling also grants the case class status, which means the temporary restraining order will grant relief to all members of the Air Force who submitted a religious accommodation request from the COVID-19 vaccine mandate from September 1, 2021. So it's not just people in a lawsuit. It's everybody who submitted a request. Now get this. This is so interesting. According to data from the Air Force, as of July 11th, over 6,800 service members have been denied religious accommodation requests. Only 104 have had their applications approved. Look at the numbers. There's 68 to 1, right?
That has to be unconstitutional.
Get this. Well, here you go. See, this is from the lawyer in the case. The proof in the case was very clear. The Air Force tried to pretend that they did individualized analysis of each service member's religious objection and that did occur in terms of the numbers of service members proving that they had a sincerely held religious belief. But then the Air Force, in its affidavits, proved that when it came to accommodating that belief, they took the position that we can't grant religious exemptions. So in other words, this is completely pretextual. You know, this right. is a real number. It's all of them.
I sent you an interview of a military doctor who was thrown out because he kept giving religious exemptions.
Yeah.
So they booted him. And interestingly enough, I've been able to confirm it with Dr. Merrill Ness. We've been getting a list. You have, so the FDA approved a vaccine that's not available in the U.S. with one exception. It's now being made available to some of the military bases. So there's an effort to force the mandate on the military by getting some of that vaccine in the United States. It's what appears to me.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping to get more of a story. I'm hoping the Defender will do a story about it.
I find that story interesting because what the Air Force did is it went to the judge and said, no, we honor religious exemptions. We've granted 104 of them. And the judge looked at that number and said, no, you have the policy.
Right.
You know, pull the other one. That's a policy. Get out of here.
Right.
You know, so in other words, these people are lying. The vaccinators, these vaccination nuts are lying and they're getting called on it by judges.
Right.
It's not just Catherine Austin Fitz and John Titus calling BS on them.
Right.
It's federal judges calling BS on them.
Right.
That's huge.
Yep. 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 And the more who call it, the more courageous the rest of the judges get.
Yep.
You're not it's alone anymore. Right.
It's and then you, people know what people see. They pick up the cues from the judges and it just radiates outward.
So you're watching, we talked about it last week, you're watching one after another leader sort of either fall or get politically castrated is what I would describe it as. So right. You've got Draghi, you've got Boris Johnson, you've got Macron, you've got Biden, on and on and on. It looks to me like, you know, all these guys have used up their political capital and they're looking to bring in a whole new round of meaner, tougher, fresh people. And so
you said that last time, and I'm not seeing the evidence of meaner, tougher. I don't doubt you. I'm just saying right. I don't see the evidence of it yet.
I don't see the evidence of it yet. I've been watching some of the, the candidates, the conservative candidates in the UK. And we're watching this climate change, whatever they're up to on climate change emergencies. That's why I want to read the NDAA. I want to see what. You know, there are going to be some bombs in the NDAA to help them with control. So that's why I want to read it, see what they're really up to. But
yeah,
you're right. I don't see the new meaner yet, but we haven't seen who the replacements are. So we'll see. Yeah.
Climate change emergencies. Like
that's
like
not going to work. It's not going to hunt. That dog's not going to hunt.
Like the sky is falling.
So they had to do COVID-19 because the climate change wouldn't hunt. It wouldn't hunt then. It's not going to hunt now.
Right.
So, you know, we're back with a big new purchase of moneypox vaccine. So maybe they think moneypox is going to go, but it seems to just bring on laughter more than anything.
Right. Silly. Okay, next story. This is a short one. John O'Looney. Hospitals are covering up baby deaths by cremating babies themselves. This is an interview. It's about 50 minutes long. O'Looney is the brave funeral home whistleblower who has been raising the alarm since early on in the pandemic, and he gives an interview here where he says basically the hospitals are covering up baby deaths. They're cremating the babies themselves instead of letting, you know, funeral homes do them. I have no way of being able to assess.
So I have no idea, but Looney has checked out. Every time I've checked Looney out, he checks out.
Yep.
And and I'm getting reports from multiple sources that, you know, baby deaths are up dramatically, and they're trying to come up with various excuses as to why. But both maternal, you know, sort of any problem related to, so everything from dropping fertility to problems on pregnancy to, you know, a death of a young child, that whole, the whole birthing process is really suffering from the injections. And I don't know how bad it's going to be, but if you listen to some pretty credible people, they think the injections from the 6 months to 4 to 5 years is going to do terrible, terrible harm.
Wow. Terrible interesting harm. Note from your subscribers, because I have no way of knowing, is it normal for a hospital to do any cremations? And if so, is it normal to do a cremation of babies? That seems, this seems way out there. If that's,
it does seem way out. So I would love to get comments on this.
Yeah.
You know, what do people think? Is this possible? Could it be true?
Are there crematoria inside of hospitals? Are you kidding? Maybe there are, because, you know, you have to have some backup in case the world goes to hell in a handbasket. But I don't know.
Right.
It seems like a very scandalous, but a very serious allegation to me. The hospitals are sort of doing these off-book cremations.
If you look at what hospitals have been doing for the last 2 years,
yeah,
in the UK, I think this is absolutely possible.
Right.
I mean, they've already proved, you know, that they will intentionally implement genocide plans. They've already proved that.
Yeah.
The euthanasia.
That was one of the things I would try to tell people, you know, with the financial crisis. Like, listen, if they're lying about $21 trillion,
right,
there's no limit on these crimes. If a bank is criminal, you've opened up a Pandora's box you don't really want to think about.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of people responded with like, yeah, you're right, I don't want to think about it. And they just ignored the whole thing.
Right.
Anyway, next story is interesting, very interesting. This is from Michael Palmer. Did Pfizer perform adequate safety testing for its COVID-19 mRNA vaccines in preclinical studies? Evidence of scientific and regulatory fraud. I wanted to, you know, that's really the headline here. This article reviews some of the publicly available documents on Pfizer's non-clinical development program. The cursory nature of the entire preclinical program can be summed up as, we did not find any safety signals because we did not look for them. But this is, so there's a laundry list of findings that Palmer makes having reviewed these documents. But look at number three. Pfizer
so
claimed,
this is Sasha, who's a very capable scientist. And Palmer's been working with Sasha.
Okay.
And I think he published that. But, you know, so they've been collaborating, and there's a lot of back and forth. So, and Sasha is very, very capable. So
look at number three here, though. Pfizer claimed absence of potential for vaccine-elicited disease enhancement based on studies of an animal species that does not get sick from SARS-CoV-2. Whoops.
I know.
That's
unbelievable.
Really, really bad. You know, and that gets into this whole thing of like, well, once people find out you're lying, you're done. You know, they're not going to believe you. And this isn't surprising at all, because we've been hammering on Pfizer. It's a criminal enterprise. They admitted to perpetrating criminal fraud. What don't you understand?
I couldn't
about
believe
that?
It. When you were describing sort of their different settlements for criminal fraud, I was reading The Empire of Pain and reading all the stories of the, you know, of the frauds that they had perpetuated decades ago. And I realized, oh, this is their model. It's their business model.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
That's their model. They want to get those pills in your body one way or the other. They want to get you hooked. They'll lie to do it. It's their model. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Let's keep it going. This is now I have to look at the notes. Like, is this pushback? You know, 'cause it's like it's all pushback now. But now this is pushback. We're going to have to change our headings. It's too confusing. Anyway, it's good. These are great developments. But right. Our first story on pushback is from the Defender. Exclusive DOD must end vaccine mandate, says Army doctor suspended for writing exemptions. Here you go. Doe versus Rumsfeld in 2003, the legal case, clearly prohibits the DOD from mandating an emergency use authorization vaccine. When challenged with this precedent, the DOD falsely asserted that the emergency use authorization vaccines can be used interchangeably with the FDA-approved Pfizer Comirnaty vaccine, ignoring the legal distinction, even if, hypothetically, the two products are identical in formulation. The DOD has utilized deceptive communications to coerce uptake of the EUA products, including the term BLA compliant, referring to, in other words, they're referring to the available EUA vaccine lots as being right. FDA-approved products, even though they're not, and then even referring to EUA-labeled BioNTech vials as Comirnaty, which, so in other words, the DOD, again, this is lying. It's not Pfizer lying. It's the DOD lying on Pfizer's behalf to get people vaccinated.
Well, but this is why they're bringing in the FDA-approved ones. And they're doing it very quietly. I've been trying to find a link or any information on it. This is the only one you can find. And I'm getting corroboration from about different military bases from the folks in CHD. But it's unbelievable. They're doing it quietly. And you can tell they're under enormous pressure to inject something into these people's bodies.
Yeah. It's incredible. Right. I want to come back to the story and look at a quote from the doctor we're talking about, the subject of the story.
Right.
Here we go. The doctor is asked, how do we verify these are FDA approved? We don't know. We can't know. There is so much deception involved on the part of the DOD and on the part of on Pfizer. It's almost impossible to know. So that's what the doctor is saying here. This guy got, no wonder he got in trouble. And he says there should be absolute public outcry due to the amount of deception. I would say that if the labeling is not exactly precisely as it should be, as it was approved, then it is best for the service member to assume that it is not the appropriate FDA-approved medication. So there you go. But it gets us lying. It's become the norm.
So here's the problem. If you look at the breakdown, the complete breakdown of any competency or ethics at the FDA and the CDC and the pharmaceutical industry, I mean, the big problem now is we've got an entire drug infrastructure and you can't trust any of it.
Yeah, damn right. You can't.
Right. You can't. You know, you can't trust the labels. You can't trust the doctors. You can't trust.
No.
I mean, we are on our own. So get ready to start making your own antibiotics.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's really incredible. I have a friend who's a professor of medicine. He's in on this. And I confront him with data, and that basically we just stopped talking because he just buys all this propaganda. He says, well, I've reviewed these Pfizer documents. I said, yeah, how do you know they're not cherry-picked? He goes, oh, they wouldn't do that. They're a criminal enterprise. Of course they would. That's what they do, guy.
It's like,
wake up.
It's
no,
like
no, saying, no, 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 no. I'm making too much money for that to be true. we stopped talking, you know.
I mean, what do you think the chances are that ultimately this gets blamed on the doctors for not providing serious due diligence and informed consent?
High. Push comes to shove.
Right.
You think they're going to throw the bankers under the bus?
Right.
They're going to find low-level doctors. You're going first. Dr. Mengele, step up.
Right.
And I said, you need to get yourself an attorney, and I don't mean a civil attorney.
Right.
You got real trouble. This is unbelievable what's going on. Anyway, next story in Pushback is great. I love this from Calgary. Firefighters filed $38 million lawsuit.
I love firefighters. Go firefighters. Yeah.
$38 million lawsuit against city fire department over COVID vaccine mandates. And there, you can see here, so there kind of gives away what the suit is about. It's not really a vaccine. But I love the point of this suit because this really gets to the nub of it. Plaintiffs say the Canadian city's injection mandate violated their basic human rights by forcing them to alter their DNA in order to continue working and making a living. And they say, we can't identify everybody behind it. In other words, we may not be able to get the central bankers, but what we can do is hold people accountable, like the fire chief, politicians, and city manager. These people are responsible for their actions.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Awesome.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
I love that.
Yep.
Yeah, that's what I say. You know, the politicians, they may not be the ones in the power, but you can get to your politicians. You can put the fear in them. That's what you need to do. Right. And that's what these firefighters are doing. I absolutely love this.
Well, here's the thing. Firefighters risk their life to protect people. And to turn to a firefighter and ask him to risk his life for no reason, just to keep his job.
Yeah.
You know, you're playing with fire, literally.
You know what's coming.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a great story. All right. Next story, a pushback from Daily Mail. Health, this is, you know, this says it all right here, doesn't it? We've got to have a story about health workers in the U.S. quitting, but we can only get this story from a European publication. Daily Mail. Health experts are quitting the NIH and CDC in droves because they're embarrassed by bad science. And I think there's a little more embarrassment going on, including vaccinating children under 5 to make their advice palatable to the White House, doctors claim. Two of America's top health agencies are reportedly hemorrhaging staff as poor decision-making described by staff as bad science has led to low morale. So the pushback really starts with this guy, Dr. Marty Makary. Major decisions made by the agencies that hurt morale included support for masking in schools, school closures during the pandemic, and the authorization of the COVID-19 vaccines for children 4 and under. Okay. Despite the evidence, the CDC still recommended schools stay closed until the end of 2019-2020 school year. So the evidence was in, there's no problem, but they were left them closed. Makary told DailyMail.com that the decision to keep schools closed was one of the worst made in the pandemic, specifically citing that minority communities who disproportionately lived in these areas were set the furthest behind academically. And there you got it.
So I've checked this with a couple of people who are much closer to those organizations than I am. And what they say is, you know, they're not sure what's really happening, in part because if you look at who's risen in those organizations, it's not like they were morally driven for a long time. But what they say is they went in and one person said that they had gone into the website to work with one section, and out of a staff of 12, there were 4 slots that were empty and they were recruiting.
Wow.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Well, that is it for pushback. And now we come to charts.
Okay. Yeah, I'm ready.
All right, let's hit it. What's going on, Euro?
So they hit parity and then backed up a little bit. But the dollar's flying and the euro is under pressure. Now, we'll see what happens with Gazprom next week. So maybe that'll help the euro a little bit. But the euro as a structure has never made sense, John. I mean, you have a fiat currency with no sovereign. You know, you have a basket of sovereign currencies that agree and don't agree. And you have no real common military behind it. So now what you had was had the industrial juggernaut of Germany and France. But now you're putting Germany at energy risk. I don't know how you hold this together is a big question mark. Other than lots of creditors who want you to stay together.
So I think the drop dead date in the Gazprom and Nord Stream is July 22nd.
I know it's next. Yeah.
We'll see how that shakes out.
Next Tuesday.
Okay.
We'll see. Well, you've got Gazprom down for maintenance, and then you've got the issue of whether you're going to get the parts from Canada. So there are two issues here. After the regularly scheduled maintenance, will they kick open, and then will they get the parts?
And it's going to be 2 weeks before our next money in markets anyway. So we'll have a lot of clarity by then.
Right.
But Germany's not looking good.
Right. I think the euro... It wouldn't surprise me to see the euro stay at approximate parity with the dollar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we'll see. Okay, let's keep it going on charts to FinViz 3-month. You know, wow, look at this.
Yeah, we're in a world of real risk. Look at the VIX.
Yeah, boy, the VIX at the top. You remember?
And inflation. It basically says, Now, commodities are coming down, and the question is, how much of that is the interest rates?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. That's a really interesting
point. It'll be interesting after, because interest rates have been softening in the market. So if the Fed bumps 75 to 100 basis points, they're not chasing the market. They're going against the market. And 75 to 100 is a meaningful bump. So if they bump that much, it'll be interesting to see what this chart looks like 2 weeks from now.
Boy, will it ever? I just don't see a 100-point bump, but, you know.
I don't see a 100-point bump, but I don't know. If I was Powell, I wouldn't back off of a 75-basis-point bump.
I think that's right. I think.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay. So now let's look. Another FinViz, the 1 year. Much different picture.
Right.
Everything's really up. Right. Where's the VIX in this one? There, it's right here. It's in the middle.
Right. A little. But that's why, you know, the Fed working for the money management world at all.
But look at this. I mean, look at the change here. It's just like the world is, something's going on. 3 months to a year. That's night and day. Anyway.
Yep.
Okay.
They're coming out of the bubble. Okay, so I just wanted to take a look at sort of the safety trade. This is gold and silver. So gold's down. This is year to date. Gold's down 5.2%. Silver down 18.22%. I just keep saying to everybody, the more silver goes down, the more I buy. So, but if you look at the silver chart, it could fall a lot more. From a technical standpoint, it doesn't look strong. And the Rambus chartology that we published this week, it's a great presentation by Rambus on both stock and precious metals markets. But one of the things he says is we're in correction and there's no sign, there's no sign of relief soon. And of course, we're in the summer. So it's sell in May and go away kind of world for both risk assets. Anyway, the bond aggregate, which is an ETF of, sort of the bond market, is down 10%. The long 20-year treasury ETF down 20%. So again, people are sucking wind on their 60 to 40 portfolios. Bonds are not, bonds are not protecting you. And that's why I've always far preferred equities and hedged equities to bonds. Huh. I just don't think bonds work anymore. The bull market is over and the credit problems are way too significant. So I think you're much better with real assets protecting you.
Boy, that's year to date. The TLT not looking so hot there.
Well, if silver takes another dive, if silver finds a lower floor, there's going to be a period here where silver is very attractive.
Yeah.
So as I said,
you're not kidding.
I can never figure out where the bottom is, so I'm just going to keep buying as it goes down.
Yep.
Okay. Next chart.
Here we go.
Yeah, so this is just a quick look at the stock market year to date. So China down 12, almost 13%. The S&P down 18.3%. The European ETF down 22%. And QQQ, which is essentially the tech companies in NASDAQ, down 26%. So the big momentum stocks are the ones that have come off the most. But the broad index is down 18%. Again, Rambus has a great piece this it's up on the web presentation for the wrap-up. And basically he says it's impossible to tell if we're in a major correction or a bear market, but, don't look for anything good to happen, in the foreseeable future. The bears are in control.
Yeah. It's not that big. Everything's down there between an eighth and a quarter. Not really. It's not terrible.
Well, here's the thing. If you're... what the market wants is what I call the stairway to heaven. They want J.P. Madoff. They want it to go up 5% a year forever. So, but here's the thing. If you look at all the shenanigans that have been used to keep the S&P up, you better hope it goes down. I don't want more of those shenanigans pumping this up on steroids.
Right. Because when it finally goes, it's going to be violent.
Right. Bernie Sanders, $50 billion for the semiconductors is designed to send QQQ back up. I'd rather have it go down than them get $50 billion to build the control grid.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Let's see what we got now. Oh, yeah. The dollar.
So the dollar is flying and the emerging markets are in a dollar bear trap. And you know, this is not just the U.S. dollar. This is the euro dollar deposits. The dollar system is an absolute command. And if you look at what they can do to, you know, put places in the debt trap and take advantage and pick up assets cheap, this is a global shopping spree. Because remember, the ECB and the Fed have pumped out the money, so the insiders have money. And anybody with a lot of dollar debt that's choking on that debt is in the corner and is going to be taken advantage of. Yep.
Wow, that's scary.
It is scary. But, you know, you have all these people saying the dollar system is going to collapse. No, the dollar system is alive and thriving right now. Yes, it's dropping slowly as reserves and part of the multipolar world. There's no one. The only one who could conceivably have given the dollar a run for their money was the euro, and the euro's down and out. So the dollar is dangerous and dominant. Don't let anybody tell you that the dollar system is collapsing. It's not.
Yeah, right. Look at that chart. It's not a collapse. That's a major rally.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Next up, this one. Look at that.
So this one, we did a wrap up in 2016 called The Rise of the Asian Consumer about the, you know, incredible shift in economic activity and power to Asia. And that's part of why the energy is being shifted out of the EU and the US. I mean, as the EU and the US become less and less important, you know, I think the investment community is shifting the energy and other assets east. It's pretty simple.
Yeah.
You look at that chart and you say, why would anybody want to shift the energy to the multipolar world? Because it's growing. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Sure is.
Right.
Okay. Are you ready for Hero of the Week and fire wrap-ups? Yeah. Okay.
So we talked about one of the Heroes of the Week last week, the Uruguay judge.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah, here we go.
Oh, you got it?
Yeah. There it is.
I love this judge. You know, Uruguay is often considered one of the great places to move to.
Yeah.
You know, and here's another piece of evidence to say, you know, Uruguay has something going for it. But this judge is insisting that they publish the contracts, including, you know, whatever is in the contracts about secret indemnification from the government for both civil and criminal violations. So I've not heard what the follow-up is, but I can imagine that health minister is scared to death.
Yeah.
Because as I've told you, I think the kickback schemes, you know, people are getting big behind the scenes and, you know, into their offshore accounts kickbacks. I think the kickback schemes here are off the charts.
Yeah. No immunity for fraud or crime. So
right.
Watch out.
Yeah. Right. And then, okay. Of course, we had a great decision in Italy as well. It's described in Hero of the Week. So it's what you said. The judges are pushing back.
Big time.
Big time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Blast from the past. Look at that.
Yeah, I had to bring this up because, you know, I've been interviewing, and we'll publish in August, some wonderful interviews with two researchers, one from the Netherlands and one from Sweden, on sort of how the power structure works. But the one that everybody misses is the Bohemian Grove. And I have to mention it because the Grove is happening, you know, it happens at the end of July in the first week of August outside of, it's in the Russian River area above San Francisco. Uh-huh. You know, and in my experience, John, here's how America worked. OK, it all revolves around fiscal and monetary policy. It's all about whacking up the money. Right.
Yeah.
So the appropriations committees vote out their appropriations, you know, in June, and then they leave for the summer recess. And then all the issues that have been teed up are rolled into the Bohemian Grove. Everybody gets together. They make their decisions. That's, you know, by the beginning of August. The instructions go out to all the bureaucrats at the central bank and at the Treasury and at Congress. And so they have until early September. The members come back and then they vote everything through. The bills are reconciled. And we have the new appropriations by October 1st. But the real thorny issues get worked out at the Grove.
No kidding.
So I'll give you a perfect example. This is my, and it used to happen at Dillon Reed. If you called the chairman of the firm when he was at the Bohemian Grove, you better have a good reason or you were in real trouble.
Okay, I was just gonna ask they, you, do you know anybody who's gone?
The answer is yes, I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And when they were there, you better not bother them because they were, you know, they wanted to have serious conversations and not be interrupted. Okay. So every year there's like this energy coming into the Grove. So Fanny and Freddie are in real trouble. Yep. And it's, I may get the dates all mashed up, but we're coming into the summer and we're coming into the Grove. I knew, you know, something's up because the collateral fraud is out of control. So I'm doing a show every week or every other week on KPFA radio in San Francisco, 5 o'clock drive by San Francisco Talk Radio, huge market. So I've been doing this for weeks. It's called Community Business or something, you know, and I've been warning about the mortgage fraud almost every week for years on KPFA radio in San Francisco drive by. Okay. So then everybody gets, so 2 or 3 weeks before the Grove, bam, I get thrown off and nobody can tell me why. And there's all kinds of lying and it's a big food fight, but bam, I'm thrown off of San Francisco radio, drive by 5 PM radio. Grove happens. They take over Fannie and Freddie. They just, you know, nationalize them.
Right,
boom.
Right.
And it turns out that the largest San Francisco money manager, one of the best money managers in the country, has taken a $1 billion loss on a Fannie Mae stock position that they bought in April.
Oh, you got to be kidding me.
No, they bought $1 billion of Fannie Mae stock in April. And then the Grove happens and they nationalize Fannie because, you know, the financial crisis, the you know what,
wow.
Is it the you know what? But it gets even, so they had, you know, but they knew they were going to do it. So they had to throw me off. They couldn't let me be talking in the middle of this. That's when I printed out my first 2,000 page bill. And so, but here's the thing. The money manager comes out and announces the press release. And they said, we had no idea there was a problem. We had no idea. So the former Assistant Secretary of Housing is on drive-by radio at 5 p.m. every week or every other week for years,
right,
explaining chapter and verse of the problem. But
the
they had
horn.
No idea there was a problem. I was like, this is so perfect.
Yeah,
this is so perfect. Anyway, so they took a $1 billion write-down. But they made sure I wasn't. Now, it's interesting. It turns out KPFA's banker was Wells Fargo, which, of course, is 10% Buffett. So I was pretty clear who got me thrown off.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Okay. Next up, an interview with Peter Bregan.
Peter Bregan. What a hero. Dr. Peter Bregan is, as far as I'm concerned, has the top credentials in psychiatry of any human being I know or know of. Incredible history, and I got him to tell a fair amount about it. But it turns out that he had read the book, The Psychology of Totalitarianism, which promotes this mass formation theory that says all the, you know, the totalitarian tendencies we're dealing with here, John, are a spontaneous eruption of our subconscious desire for strong leaders.
Yeah.
So I want you to know, John, that Karsten CBDC is a spontaneous reflection of your desire for a strong leader.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Right.
And that gets us into a book review here.
Yeah. So before I did the interview with Peter has written a book review, which he has not yet published, but hopefully we'll have it up this week. And then Ulrich Groniger, who runs our Future Science, who helped me, you know, my immediate reaction to the mass formation hypothesis a year ago was beyond negative. I just thought it was the biggest load of pile of, you know, doo-doo squad I had ever heard. I couldn't believe anybody was taking it seriously.
Yeah.
I just couldn't believe it. And it was shocking and scary to me that anybody would buy any of this. And so the question is, why is anybody believing it or buying it anyway? Ulrich really helped me kind of figure it out. We did an interview called Control and Freedom Happen One Person at a Time. And we kept talking. And then what happened was the professor who's been proposing this publish the book. And, you know, all the people who thought it was acceptable based on the interviews, when he puts it down in black and white, I mean, you're pretty clear what this guy's saying. And I assure you, it has nothing to do with what's been going on.
Yeah, right.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
A lot of people go for it, but
I know.
Anyway,
I,
so
if you say 2 + 2 = 5 with confidence, and you have a CNN, you know, lower third over you, just, you know, a good 40% of the population will believe you.
Actually, if you look at the latest Gallup polls, the media is down in the 16 to 20%.
Yeah, that's true. Very low, yeah. But still, those credentials and the confidence, people love that confidence. Like, oh, what is he talking about? I know this. Because I see these people like stars of YouTube spewing this nonsense, and their fans are like, oh yeah, he's, you know, so and so says this, it must be true. It's like, no, he's just wrong.
I don't know. The Great Resist is on.
Yep.
Okay.
Reminder of Sovereignty coming out.
Yeah, the PDF is available. It's fabulous.
Yeah.
And the hard copy is going to mail next week in Europe, and a week or two following in the United States. So here it comes.
Yeah,
it's great.
And I got to tell you, I have started a video series. So the print publication Sovereignty, I'm doing a video series called Murder of a Rebel Nation. It's basically the video version of Sovereignty. I'm going to walk you the whole thing. And I've actually just last week put out the first part of it.
And it's fabulous. And we got it up in Solarian the News, and you can get it at Best Evidence at YouTube.
Yeah, it's called Presenting America's Real Coup d'Etat. And it is my best thumbnail that I've ever done. Here you go. So if you don't like my thumbnail, don't tell me. I'm very proud of that thumbnail. It's very good.
How did you make it?
I made it with a lot of different programs to put it together. So I went on eBay and I found the Obama doll. And then I'm like, it's the wrong shape. I needed a rectangle. Video.
Yeah.
You need short and wide. But the Obama doll is this. So I needed something else. So I found another toy on eBay, like a playset. Then I had to fuse them together.
So I confess, I love the Amarova. So this is as good as the Amarova, but I can't say it's better because I did love the Amarova.
The Amarova, I got to tell you, there's an artist in Chicago who was locally famous for doing depictions of people in bad behavior. His name is Bruce Elliott. He ran a bar, still does as far as I know, the Old Town Ale House in Old Town, and he has a lot of his paintings are up. And I sort of was thinking of his style with the Omarova one, with the stick up with the shoes and the purse.
Yeah. I think designating her sticky fingers really contributed mightily to getting rid of her. I really do.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know, but you know, I'll take it. It's, you know, the win for me with Omarova being batted down isn't so much that, you know, I contributed to that in any way. It's that I said something. You know, right. I got out there and took a position publicly, and I did everything within my power, and that's all anyone can ever do.
That's all anyone can ever do, but you never know.
You never know
what will go, and you never know. And what we're watching is a snowball. So, you know, it's exactly what Wim Hof says. It's on the flip side of the cover, on the back, on the right. You're stronger than you think you are.
You're stronger than you think you are.
You're stronger than you think you are.
So don't believe that people say, oh, what you say doesn't matter. It does.
It does.
It does. The most important thing is it matters to you.
And it matters to me and you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. It matters to us.
That's what I mean. It matters to the person doing the thing, you know. So at least you can look at yourself in the mirror and say, I did everything I could do to stop this.
Right.
That's what it's about.
Hey, the Great Resist is on and we're having fun. So come on in.
Yeah. It's gotten a lot easier to do money in markets. I got to tell you.
Yep. It is.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else, John Titus?
No, that's it.
No. Okay. Well, what's our theme?
The Great Resist is on.
You betcha. You betcha. You betcha. Have a great 2 weeks. We'll talk in 2 weeks.
I will see you in a fortnight.
Okay. Get set up and have a great time.
Right.
Bye.
Bye.